It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking about taking the long view of climate change and evolution while focusing on defining moments that were in Earth's history. What were the critical thresholds? What events have occurred? And we will look at the pressures in the hydrological cycle due to human activity. What are we doing that affects our water? And finally, a little bit of a look at the industrialization of water, quality and scarcity in those questions.
And I'm Dr. Krista Longton, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at IUPUI and Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. With us today is my friend and colleague, Gabriel Filippelli, PhD, Chancellor's Professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and the Executive Director of the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute. Thanks for being with us today, Gabe.
It's a pleasure, and that's kind of a mouthful, isn't it?
I think both of us have the mouthful titles. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
I have the simplest.
It's true. So I would love to, in the context of Mark's great introduction, Gabe, if you could talk a little bit about your work with, let's start with the Environmental Resilience Institute, and then maybe we'll transition later. But start there and kind of talk a little bit about how the ERI sort of helps us to think about the role of water and the history of climate change in the state of Indiana and how that might affect the future.
Sure, I'm happy to. And I think it comes timely because in this week in March 2023, a landmark and shocking report landed from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, outlining the very clear impacts of climate change on the hydrologic cycle, driving droughts and floods. And we're not immune here in Indiana. So we have experienced a significant uptick in flooding, which impacts not only communities, right, flooded streets and stormwater discharges, but also farmers who, especially if they can't get a crop in on time or not at all, in fact. You know, but we have this odd combination, as a lot of areas are experiencing, of not only flooding, but drought. We have a number of drought cycles that have increasingly intensified over the years. So what our role is in the Environmental Resilience Institute is to take the science that we have already. So we have pretty good science about what the climate trajectory of Indiana and the Midwest will look like, and use it to inform communities on how to make their best choices on being resilient to the impact, right? No individual can change climate change, right? Collectively, we certainly could, and we have to, the report from the IPCC tells us we got to get going fast at this. We're behind. But nevertheless, in the meantime, that climate change, this wacky weather, this climate fueled, is already upon us. So we've got to deal with it. And communities need answers. And they often are under-resourced. So that's where we come in. We try to put the best science possible to provide equitable, sustainable, and actionable solutions for communities and businesses and nonprofits.
You know, Gabe, when you talk about that, you know, a lot of people in Indiana think they're immune, you know, because we have so much water around us. And I thought it was interesting when you say that, because the extremes are what are there. In fact, I was trying to explain to somebody else, I think we got out ahead of the game by saying global warming, because people think that it's always warming. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand that for a farmer, it could be that it warms up early, the crops come up early, and then all of a sudden they get a sudden frost that then destroys that crop. And that's what we're talking about, isn't it, when we're talking about global climate change?
Indeed. That's been kind of one of the most, I think, impactful aspects of climate change is the extremes, like you pointed out, Mark. And for example, here in Indiana, we don't have to spin up a fancy model to guess what temperature and climate has, how temperature and rainfall have already changed, because we measure that stuff, right? We've been measuring it for 100 years. What we see is that over the last 20 years or so, the overall net precipitation has increased a little bit. And remember, as hydrologists think of precipitation as a combination of rain, snow, and ice, right? Snow has gone down quite a bit as we experience. That's as a consequence of warming. But what we're having is, even though the average precipitation has gone up a little bit, about 2 or 3 inches, the extreme events have increased substantially by about 15% over the last two decades. And that's not a fancy climate model. That's actually just putting out rain gauges, right, all over the state. And it's exactly that. It's that, you know, you get a flooding event week after week after week in the springtime, and nobody can put a crop in, right? And storm systems overflow and sewage runs into waterways.
And then we end up with, for the farmer, replanting or delayed planting, which starts getting them into a fall season where we're again unpredictable for harvest. And so one of the things, not that farming was ever predictable, but being in an agricultural state, the more we make it this kind of volatility in it, I would think that that should be of concern to anyone in Indiana.
It should. And we think of farming as the normal things you see when you drive out in rural Indiana, right? Corn and soybean. But actually, some of our most high value crops are our forests, our timber products. And they also are feeling the impacts of actually a little bit more intense summer drying combined with pests. You know, that's just, you know, it's not like climate change necessarily increased pests, but, you know, us moving things back and forth increased pest loads. And it's starting to eat into this very valuable agricultural product.
Wow.
I'm wondering if we can maybe back up a little bit and talk about the term hydrologic cycle, in part because, as Mark said, you know, I know that our listeners are engaged and connected to these things. But I think when I think of the hydrologic cycle, or when folks think of it, they might start by just thinking about rainfall. You mentioned snow. You also mentioned sort of changes in temperature. Can you talk a little bit about, when you say that term hydrologic cycle, what exactly you mean, and how more information about that cycle might help us make better decisions?
Yeah, happy to. When we think of the hydrological cycle, we're just talking about water in the atmosphere, or water in the soils, or water in the deep subsurface, right? There's water in all three of those places. And so in a simplistic way, you can think of the hydrological cycle in frameworks of just simply the precipitation we receive, right? That's usually, you know, rain, snow, and ice. That's one component of it. But, you know, the soil itself actually is a huge reservoir for water. And that's the reservoir that plants use, right? Plants don't extract water from the atmosphere typically. They extract it from the root systems. And so you have to add both of those things in. And you can imagine, here's an interesting scenario, interesting conundrum. Even with the same amount of rainfall year after year, let's say that that's the case, increased summer warming, which we're definitely experiencing, will actually decrease crop yields because the soil moisture will evaporate, right? We know humidity, right? That's hot, that's warm, wet air. That doesn't necessarily mean warm soil, wet soil at least. So the soil starts drying out, even with the same amount of rainfall. So that's what hydrologists think about. And then they even think more deeply, right? We extract a significant amount of our drinking water from the subsurface, right? From wells, which you're familiar with. And these well fields themselves can be either over-extracted, or they can dry out, or, you know, frankly, they can be contaminated, in which case it makes it unsafe to drink water.
Yeah, we don't think about, and, you know, we don't really realize how important, and I think you as a geologist and working in that area, it's to how important that underground water is. The water in the soil is important, but then the replenishment of the water that's under. I know Indianapolis draws a lot from aquifers that are under in many parts of Indiana. And we always think, well, there's a lot of surface water, or we have reservoirs. But really, a big source, and I would assume a big source for industry and agriculture, are those underground areas. How is that being affected?
It's being affected somewhat because our average rainfall has been about the same, a little bit increased, in fact. The potential of those aquifers are still pretty high. However, we've already seen over-extraction of a number of reservoirs, particularly where you have a high population, right? For example, Indianapolis, we've over-extracted and sort of under-planned for the growth of Indianapolis and its suburbs and exurbs. So there's new well fields had to be opened up south of the city. Similarly, in near West Lafayette, there's a huge controversy right now about a massive planned extraction facility for industrial uses of water. And the concern there, of course, is if you suck out all the water from below, there's not enough for people to drink. And not only that, but it can cause some, not so much in Indiana, but in other places, over extraction of water, like in California, has caused deflation of the entire landscape. Right. So you have actually some areas of the Central Valley of California, very resourceful fruit basket, or you know, the country's fruit basket, have sunk by as much as 20-30 feet. And you'd think, okay, well, that's not so bad. It's just sinking ground. But by that deflation of the water underneath it, it's allowed salt water from the delta to invade, as it were. So it's a hydrological cycle. You're right. It considers everything, you know, even though we see it as, you know, because we get free water from the tap, right? We don't think about groundwater or reservoirs. We just think of it as the inconvenience of rain and snow, but it's much more complicated. And a lot more, Krista, to your point, what we are just grappling with is not understanding how to measure those things at present. We know how to measure those quite well, but it's how to project them in the future. And one of the products of the Environmental Resilience Institute is a program platform called Future Water, where you can look at different climate scenarios and look at how much water is in soil. Like, what's the soil moisture in 2050 in this one portion of Vandenberg County? I don't know where Vandenberg County is, but I know it's in Indiana. And so you can get down to those details. And so that's our attempt to use the best science to help farmers and stormwater managers plan.
That's a really good point, that one of the things that you start thinking about there are how, you know, it's very easy to think about what does tomorrow look like. It's much harder to think about 2050, 2075. And I think that that's one of the things, as folks think about the concept of climate science and how it sort of shapes our decision-making process, is that we're playing a really long game, which can feel hard, I think, for some folks. I was listening to a recent podcast with Catherine Hayhoe, who's also a climate scientist, and she was talking about temperature change in terms of a fever, mm-hmm. as a metaphor. And I was wondering, as you think about the way that you approach talking about your work, talking about climate science with the Environmental Resilience Institute and the other work you do, how do you help folks get a sense of thinking about that long game in a way maybe that Dr. Hayhoe did, with thinking about it like, you know, you're, you know, when your temperature is 98, you think of, you know, warming 3 or 4 degrees is not that much, but if your temperature is 101, you're in rough shape. And so I'm wondering how you've approached kind of thinking about your work differently in the context of helping folks to see the long game.
Yeah, excellent. And actually, Catherine's a board member of the ERI as well. And she's a very, you know, probably one of the most articulate of the climate communicators out there, because she's very personal. And the way that she does it is realizing and recognizing that normal human beings, when they're presented with numbers like dealing with climate change, 1.5 degrees C, or you know, that's about 3.1 degrees Fahrenheit, it means nothing to them. It's just a number. And scientists have long thought that, oh, we need to get more facts. If they just got more facts, they would feel like really inspired for action, because they'd be really scared. Well, more facts actually are even less convincing. There's been a number of studies that show that. So Catherine's approach is clever and influential. And that's the one what we've been taking at the Environmental Resilience Institute. And that is to tell this climate story through story. Tell climate change through stories. Things that are personal, like you mentioned, the fever. Yeah, you feel crappy at 101 and a half degrees, but that's how much we've raised global temperature. And so we try to connect them through stories. And the way we're doing that is we've developed a set of case studies within ERI that actually aren't just the data on climate models. They're actually how communities are grappling with the challenge of climate change. And we are also developing, we're a finalist for an AR prize right now. This is a augmented reality prize competition where we're taking some of our very data specific tools that are very helpful for city managers to use, but not really engaging for a human being, a grandma somewhere in, you know, Pittsburgh, Indiana. But the AR challenge, we are using a bunch of AI tools like the famous ChatGPT and the similar AI version of a visual platform, one that makes graphics. We are using that to tell the story of our data science. So we're trying to think about how we can engage people in some of these issues that maybe are not inherently engaging. One other point that I wanted to make, if I can, is the reason why we focus a lot on bringing climate resilience to communities is when you're a mayor, let's say, you're a mayor of a town, you don't have a lot of money, you actually don't even have much expertise in climate planning, but you are faced with dealing with flooded streets, dealing with higher power prices, and maybe an aging city fleet of vehicles. You're thinking, okay, how am I going to manage all this? But you are also, mayors don't think about tomorrow. They're thinking about, I mean, maybe they do think about the next election, but the good city managers are thinking about 10 to 50 years out, right? Because the infrastructure that they invest in now is still going to be around then, depending on the type of infrastructure. So we go to these places and work with them to show how, for example, financial models of converting a fleet, rotating out a fleet of internal combustion engine vehicles and replacing them with electric, when paired with a large solar installation, is the ideal solution for grid stability, reducing cities' energy prices, and actually, if you have the right kind of system, you know, electric vehicles can actually feed your grid at times of grid stress. It can backfeed it. So these are the kinds of things that they need to know the math, though, to convince people that the math works out, folks. 5 years, this is going to be paying off, and then we're just making money after 5 years.
Yeah, it's getting so. What you're talking about, really, and I always thought of it as long time and short time. But you also have a midtime here. So one of the things that I think is interesting is, the geological stuff is really, really long time.
Yeah,
I mean, even what we're going to do now, it's going to take a long time for it to manifest itself. But you've got that midtime, which is, I think, interesting because the stories help tell that one. You know, we can, the science, the data tells us now, here's what it is. But what you're trying to do is get somebody to look, what is it 50 years out, you know, 25 years out, and maybe not 1,000 years out? What is that? But in terms of that, what the cost benefit is, if I do these things now, they may be at a higher cost now, but in midtime thinking, it pays out.
Indeed. I mean, we make this decision all the time, right? When we save, when we put money in for our kids' college, you know, at the time that they're born, we didn't know that, oh, well, we'll do a college fund. Yeah, it's going to cost us money now, but we're going to be very happy we did it, right? So we make these long time. Having said that, Mark, you know, I'm a geologist also at heart. I love the last 4.2 billion years. I love thinking about it. I love talking about it. I wrote an entire book about it over my sabbatical. I really get excited by that. However, you're right. I always put the geek side away when I'm talking to communities because they might in theory like that, but they want to know what to do in 2 years.
Although I do think you have something in your storytelling. You know, there are some real, because you know, I worked in museums, some real touch points in there: dinosaurs, extinctions. Mm-hmm. And we get those in the geologic record, and they really give us hints, don't they, towards some of the science that we're looking at even today?
They do. Many of the past mass extinctions, or several of them, were climate fueled. Obviously, it weren't people tinkering with climate, but they were climate fueled. And our current mass extinction has been termed the sixth mass extinction, is one that is also climate enhanced, but obviously it's also just from the way we've managed and overexploited landscapes and wildlife.
Wow. The idea of storytelling, and I know that's just not a new breakthrough with some things, but I think it is in science a relatively new idea to do that. And I know, Krista, some of your work really is in how do we improve communication. I know you're working in the medical center to do that. So maybe both of you talking a little bit about the power of a story to motivate people to and to help them understand. So one, to help them understand, then motivate them to take some action.
One of the things, I'll jump in. One of the things that I have a group of graduate students working on right now is the relationship between stories and uncertainty. And I think, Gabe, you've been involved in that, so thanks for that. But it's interesting to think about the idea that, you know, to both of your points, it is hard as humans to think about beyond our own lifetimes. And I mean, I moved to Indianapolis from the Chicago area 20 years ago, and I see a significant difference in what weather is like, what, you know, what the climate is like here. And I started coming to Indianapolis as an undergraduate student, you know, 30 years ago. And just in my lifetime, things are very different. And I think that for some of us who are Generation Xers, you know, we have seen that. And then I think for the folks who come after us, millennials obviously see that, right? They talk very articulately about the changes that they've seen and they know they will see in the climate. And I think sometimes it's harder for folks, kind of depending on where you sit in your life, to think about what do we do with this, this sense of uncertainty that we feel. And the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, was a place where we saw lots of, in my case, health scientists who were thinking about talking about uncertainty. And we learned a ton from climate scientists. So a lot of the work that I've done recently looks at how have health scientists taken some of the storytelling strategies that climate scientists have been using for many years as a strategy to think about talking about uncertainty during the pandemic. Because I think it's very easy to be a bit fatalistic about uncertainty, right? To say, we can't predict the future. But to some extent, we have very good data that will help us to make some pretty solid predictions about how the climate will change if we don't intervene. And I think to your point, Gabe, the report that came out this past week really illustrates the idea that these are decision points, right? These are moments where we need to make decisions, and having a mix of data and story helps us to make better decisions. And you know, whenever I talk about these concepts, I always say, like, we can see human emotion as a detriment, or we can see it as sort of our superpower, that we can get more people engaged and more people connected if we do use stories as a tool to say, I know that this science seems heady and far away, but let me tell you about the experiences of this farmer or of this city planner, or of this, you know, this person who's dealing with you know, some of their own well issues or water issues. And I think that those shifts can pay dividends, provided that we train folks how to communicate in that way. And that's, you know, the focus of my work. But I know, Gabe, you have sort of, as you've said, kind of over the course of your career, have sort of changed your approach to thinking about working with the community. And I'm wondering maybe if you would be willing to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I can just tell one story. I think that tells the whole story. Scientists are their own worst enemies usually when communicating with science, because we're so used to communicating to each other that we forget that normal human beings won't understand what we're talking about. They don't need to, right? We use jargon that's specialized. I don't need to teach somebody. It's not my job to teach everyone every fact about what I do. It is my job to make sure that people understand the relevance of science in their everyday life, right? And this is something that scientists, yes, some of the climate scientists are very good at this. Some of them are very bad at it as well. But here's a story that I tell, and it makes my wife look wonderful and makes me look terrible, is that, you know, when I used to talk about climate change, this is back probably about 10 years ago, when it was, there was you know, the last 10 years has shown that the planet stopped absorbing our carbon insults, and now it's lashing back with, you know, the intensity of climate impacts, you know, the flooding, wildfire, drought, hurricane. So 10 years ago, maybe there was a little bit less uncertainty among the populace, certainly lots of certainty among scientists. But I would want to convince people of the science. I would want to start off my talks about the physics of carbon dioxide and what we know about these details and how it changes the planetary temperature. And my wife would say, well, you don't need to be right about the science part if people are taking the right actions, right? If people are saying, well, I don't care about climate change, but I still think it's a good idea to buy an electric car, for example. And so my story is this, is that it got me to the point where when I would talk to somebody in a rural community, for example, or a farmer, they certainly have certain political and partisan views and cultural backgrounds, and I have to respect that. But I won't talk about climate change when I have a conversation with them about the environment. I'll ask them about the weather, especially some of the older farmers, like you recognize, Chris, some of the older farmers. If I start talking about blizzards and floods, they will tell me the story of climate change through their own lived experience, right? They will say that, well, back in the 90s, I used to be able to do this, this, or that. Now I can't do that anymore. Now I've got to do this. Now I've got to crop later. Now I've got to do all of these things. I have to switch my corn and soybean whatevers. And so they are recognizing that climate is changing. They just don't want to use the word climate change. And so I just use weather. And, you know, again, usually in most cases, the wives are smarter than their bullheaded husbands, but I don't die on my sword of the science of climate change. If it's weather that's going to get the message across, that's great. Let's talk weather.
I love that. And you're exactly right. That language can really trip us up, and it gets so politicized, particularly it always has, but now I think more than ever. And avoiding starting what you're saying is by starting a conversation with somebody where they are. And so that means you have to learn a little bit about them, right? And I know that's what you teach, Krista. You have to first have a generalized conversation that isn't about the point you're trying to get to. It's just kind of, you know, what are you seeing on your farm, or it's the weather, which we can all talk about. And then all of a sudden you're into a deeper conversation because you're knowing where they are and what the touch points are. And I think that is how all of us need to approach talking about those things that we're most scared about. And I think it gets politicized for a lot of reasons, but I also think it's because people get so afraid. And they also don't realize, they don't believe they can do anything. It's just so massive. Do you run into people that are just almost fear? They just can't even move because this is such a big topic. The planet is warming, and we get so much fear out of that sometimes that they don't even know what to do.
Climate anxiety is a huge issue, particularly among younger folks. Some of them funnel that anxiety into activism. Which actually works. Yeah. It really works. But what I don't want to see is that anxiety funneled into nihilism, right? So there's Mary Anais Hagler, a phenomenal climate journalist, coined this term denialism. So they're not denying the fact of climate change, but they're not doing anything about it because they say, well, the planet's going to burn up. You shouldn't have any more kids, blah, blah, blah. And the planet's not going to burn up. Yes, it's going to get hotter. It's going to, you know, our weather system will continue to get wackier if we don't, you know, we've already jacked it up now. This is basically now this wacky stuff. This is now our climate.
Right. It's right? Norm.
It's now our normal. And so this is why the Resilience Institute recognizes that and says, okay, we can't assume that in 10 years it's all going to all go back. You know, right. This wackiness is us now. And we would like to get it less wacky in the future. And this is where, like, we try to take anxiety and convert it into action. So that's either voting, such a powerful climate action, That's a personal action that every single person can do, vote. The last election, for example, took an administration that was very business focused and fossil fuel focused to one that has to pass the biggest climate bill that we've ever seen, right? And that was largely pushed by the youth climate activists and other progressives, right? This administration is not perfect. They just approved this Willow project to extract more fossil fuels. But nevertheless, voting is such a powerful way to funnel that anxiety and also talking about climate, talking about everywhere to everyone, even crazy Uncle Joe at Thanksgiving.
We've been talking with Gabe Filippelli, obviously, about climate change and now resiliency. Please join us for more conversation after this short break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Krista Longton, and today we're having a conversation with Gabe Filippelli about defining moments in the Earth's history where critical thresholds have occurred. And as we went to break, Gabe, you were telling us a little bit about kind of your work with a focus on story and thinking about how your work has changed a little bit over time. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about the notion that climate science sometimes sneaks up on us, maybe, that we have data, but that sometimes it's hard to see the patterns in those data to be able to predict action. And I know that certainly in your field in the past 30 years or so, you've seen changes to the way that we interpret data, the way that we talk about that. So I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about the long game that you play and how that shapes your approach.
Yeah, because I think that's a really important way to visualize how science informs society more broadly. Most climate scientists harken back to 1988 when a NASA scientist, James Hansen, testified to the Senate that there was a 99% certainty that climate change was occurring and that it will worsen with the emissions of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, right? So that's 1988. So the concept of global warming and so forth was already out there. Well, during the 70s and 80s, guess which group of scientists also had identified that and also had modeled climate change up until the mid-2020s? Well, these were Exxon scientists. Their science team had already predicted, based on the growth of fossil fuels and the continued use of them by society, they had predicted exactly what climate was going to look like in 2020 because of their product. And where did that science go? Nowhere, of course. It was squelched and was never publicly released. So when we think about the progression of science, there's open science, the James Hansons and the NASAs of the world. And then there is the very powerful anti-science lobby. Sometimes it's the corporations themselves who are protecting their own interests. Sometimes they are lobbying firms that basically are being paid by the corporations to protect their interests, right? And so a lot of these, the uncertainty about climate change is not because of us. I'm pointing at me, a climate scientist. It's not because we don't know how to do the math of carbon accounting. We know how to do that very well. We actually know how to model climate extremely well. Most of the uncertainty, that the public uncertainty about it, is because largely corporate interests have made it seem confusing, made it seem a future thing, made it seem like something that scientists didn't know how to predict. No, the only thing we don't know how to predict, and sorry for getting on my soapbox, I'll get off of it in a moment. The only thing that we don't know how to predict is what you, I, and the United States and China and India are going to do in terms of carbon emissions, right? We don't know that carbon trajectory in the future. So when you hear about uncertainty in the model, well, scientists say it's either going to be 10 degrees warmer or 5 degrees warmer. Yeah, it's not because we don't know math. It's because we don't know what we're going to be doing. And so that's where we've seen that transition is scientists continuing to try to get a message across. branded kind of ineptly for a long time until you really got the great climate communicators of Catherine Hayhoe, Marshall Shepard, Michael Mann, and others, who then are reinforced by one critical thing we can't lose sight of, is that it's almost, I mentioned this earlier, it's almost as if the earth has buffered our carbon insults for a very long time, so that you and me and the farmer in Pittsburgh haven't really felt climate change personally until the last 10 years. And it's almost like, well, all of our protections are off, and let's have at it. Let's see what carbon let's see it do its worst. And it is doing its worst, you know, and we're seeing that, of course, in this extremely destructive weather patterns that we're seeing, which are climate fueled. We're also seeing it by the fact that, you know, you want to take a guess when the eight hottest years in recorded history have been? The last 8 years. If you ask me back in two more years, I'll add up the list of 10. What's the 10 hottest years? The last 10 years, and so forth and so on. So I see that's a progression, actually.
Yeah, I agree. And so what I think is happening in this, Gabe, is that you've got the competing interests, like you said, and they're very powerful. They have a lot of money. They have a vested interest in keeping their product, which is where their lifeblood is. They want the science because they really want maybe even to know what they're liable for at some point, right? But they don't want to publish that science because they don't want the public to then join in the change. But I think what you said that was profound is the idea that we can predict pretty accurately if we have the data. And what is not there is the data of how humans may respond. That we can't predict, but we can predict how the climate is doing it. And so I think that's really a profound statement, because it's not that our science isn't really solid. It is, our science is very solid. It's just humans aren't giving us the indication of what else we need for our model.
One of the things that's interesting to me too, we don't have to go too far down this rabbit hole, but I think to your point about being able to predict human behavior is, that we do have other examples of places where we have changed behavior associated with and against corporate interests. If we use the tobacco lobby, for example, right? We've seen in the United States, tobacco use decrease really dramatically, in part because we've legislated for it. So we've changed those laws to make it harder for folks to get addicted to tobacco, you know, through taxing the sale of tobacco and through making it less accessible to minors. And so if we think about kind of what are the ways that we can predict human behavior, we know that it's often very hard for us as humans to make these kinds of really long-term decisions on their own. Certainly more people, to your point, Gabe, should save for their kids to go to college, right? I should say, you know, my rainy day fund doesn't look like it should. And I think that's one of those places where we know that it's helpful to have some level of supportive intervention from a policy standpoint. And that doesn't mean controlling people's behaviors, right? You can still make choices, but we want to make it easier for folks to make better choices. And that, to me, is the work that the ERI is doing, right? That the Environmental Resilience Institute is doing, is helping folks make better choices in that long game, in the way that we've done with tobacco in the United States.
That's exactly right. And you can either think of it as you're fighting a system, or you're at least butting up against the vested interests of a system. And those aren't always evil interests. But I take this example as our friends visited us from California a couple months ago, and they're driving their Tesla, right, to an electric vehicle. And they had no problem getting here, but it was a very carefully charted route, right, based on temperature or range, charging station type, right? Different cars have different, they're not compatible yet, right? And they're not very available. Charging stations are not very available in a lot of places. So it was this complicated math. It's, you know, that the cars know how to do a lot of the calculation themselves. So that's great. But if I had to take the same road trip from California to Indiana, driving an internal combustion engine, you know how much I'd worry about range anxiety or availability of a certain type of gas, Shell or Exxon or BP? Well, there's no issue there. There's, you know, I was driving out yesterday near west side of Indianapolis, on the corner of 38th Street and one of the other north-south roads. There's three different gas stations. Each corner of the four corners, three of them had a gas station, right? So you don't have to worry about infrastructure. So that's the built-in advantage that that fossil fuel industries have. And by the way, they call themselves energy companies now, which is absolutely bogus. But that is where policy makes a huge difference, right? The Biden administration has come out with a couple of things. Like, we're going to put so many charging stations out there that it's going to be stupid not to have an electric vehicle. We are going to require them to have universal charging adapters, right? That's a new thing. Europe did that a while ago. Said none of these shenanigans about, well, I can only use Shell gas or ExxonMobil gas. You're going to use the same charger. It's not a taking away from people. It's not removing personal rights. It's actually policy intervening against a systemic, you know, entrenched systemic systems that we know are bad. They're bad for our health. Tobacco is bad for our health. Carbon's bad for our health, right?
Yeah, and they're working, Gabe, within the new industries that are there. So you've got a lot of auto companies, including some of the largest auto companies, not just Tesla, but some of the largest auto companies in the world. I think of Toyota. I think of GM. I mean, they're moving fully into electric. They're going to have a lot of influence and pressure on what you're talking about, which is getting a universal infrastructure built.
Indeed.
As well. And I think, yeah, again, it's in their best interest because they can see what's coming and they see what's there. And you're right. And there'll be new energy companies, even though I agree with you that the others call themselves that, they're not there. And in any way, they might give a nod to it and put one electric charging thing in a gas station. But it's going to be there's a whole lot of changes that have to happen with that. The other thing that I think is really interesting, and we talk about this a lot on when I have other people on, but can you describe a little bit what we mean by the difference between resistance, which I think is what happens often, and resilience?
Interesting. Some of the same roots, right? Resilience, the way we define it, is the capacity of a system. And I'm going to get less theoretical. I'm going to talk the capacity of a town, Fort Wayne, Indiana, let's say, to have stormwater systems that don't discharge raw sewage when extreme rainfall event occurs, or have urban downtowns where there's a lot of communities and maybe vulnerable lower income communities, not having them be 5 or 10 degrees hotter than other regions because they are experiencing this urban heat island, right? So resilience is understanding the present and future environmental situation and putting in solutions to allow for communities to be less burdened and hopefully in so doing be more equitable. Resistance is I interpret that as two ways. One is you're resisting change. A system is always going to resist change, right? Until change is thrust upon it, and then it'll respond. But there's also a different kind of resistance, which is what I like to see is resistance to the status quo, right? There are a lot of people. I was in the State House testifying on something a couple of weeks ago. There's a lot of people who say, we're here in the state of Indiana. The status quo, if you look at us from a national lens, is that, oh, we're all, we're a red state who's resistant to doing any change. In fact, that's not exactly true. We, as part of our work in Environmental Resilience Institute, we did something called the Hoosier Life Survey. We conducted the statewide survey of 2,000 residents across all ideological and political leanings. We wanted to explore. We wanted to take the temperature of Hoosiers about literally taking the temperature about what they think about global climate change and what they think about the environment and so forth. And the stunning result of that, we did this before the pandemic and kind of mid pandemic. The stunning result is that the percentage of Hoosiers who were concerned about climate change and environmental impacts was consistent throughout. It was about 72% worried about climate change, 72% felt that humans were causing it, or at least partly responsible. That and the environment was on one of their top concerns about the future. During the middle of the pandemic, yeah, the pandemic rose up, but climate was still right up there, just still hugged the periphery as, you know, this is a big thing for Hoosiers. And yes, Republicans were a little bit less concerned or less convinced than Democrat, but to conceive of Indiana as a state that's going to resist any change or any creative solutions to climate change, it's not true. That's not how people feel.
And I think one of the things to me that is powerful about that, and one of the conversations we had earlier that I think is worth underscoring, is the idea that what is in, to some extent, in our control is human behavior, right? Like we can't, like that there are parts of this that we can't control at this point, right? The horse is out of the barn, so to speak. But one of the things that we can maybe influence, is a better way than to say control, is through storytelling, through data sharing, through engagement, through connection, right? Having those conversations that you were talking about, Gabe, we can help folks see that there are ways to make better decisions that make us more resilient, and also can help us to play that long game, to think into the future. You know, I think about the idea that it's, you know, it's March and it's Indiana, so of course I'm watching a lot of basketball. And I was saying to a friend the other night, I watched one of those basketball players fall and get up so quickly. And I, a couple of weeks ago, you know, we had one of those kind of freak ice storms here in Indianapolis, and I fell going up the stairs to my house. And I kind of said to myself, you know, as a middle-aged person at this point, I'm really glad that I've been running and lifting recently, because it was a little bit easier for me to recover from that fall. And I look at those, you know, really young, spry, very fit basketball players, and they get up like it's nothing, right? And I think about how this relates to climate change, right? Sort of making those small day-to-day changes, making those small decisions are about what is going to help us be able to get up really fast, like a basketball player when we fall, right? And I think that's the message that I hear in what you're saying, Gabe, is that part of this is about thinking about how do we incentivize the right behaviors, and how can we help folks see the impact of their decision-making process.
I love that. And too bad that it doesn't seem like any Indiana teams are continuing on, of course, but on both men and women's side. But I certainly feel my resilience being tested by the years on my body. But yeah, it's interesting. One of our most successful programs is the McKinney Midwest Climate Project. And I know that's kind of a mouthful, but the McKinney Family Foundation funds this project. And it's a program where we train and place about 40 students from IU, from multiple campuses. Granted, it's largely Bloomington and Indianapolis campuses, but we place them in cities and towns and nonprofits who want somebody to help them deal with environment or climate issue, right? So we put them in for summer, and now we're increasingly putting them in for summer and then the entire following year. We have fellows placed in big cities like Indianapolis. We have them in organizations like the Indianapolis Airport Authority, and we have them in small little towns all over the state. The reason why I bring that up is that it's an extremely popular program for municipalities, because they don't have the capacity to do something like a greenhouse gas inventory themselves, or develop a climate action plan, or develop a stormwater management plan, right? So we've placed fellows in Republican towns and Democrat towns. It doesn't really matter, because people want solutions at that local level, right? And what I like about the story aspect is those students are not just bringing data and facts. They're actually bringing themselves as human beings and, you know, kind of student experts and learners to these communities, and learning a little bit about maybe how Crawfordsville, Indiana, how they think in the city county building. And so they're actually training the next generation of whether you want to think of it as sustainability managers or climate change professionals or whatever, we're training the next generation as well. So it's been a phenomenal program to see, and it's been growing every single year.
That's great. We've been talking about climate change and resilience, and we'll be right back after this.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Gabe Filippelli about climate change, geologic time, and where we might be headed with life on Earth. Now, Gabe, I know that talking about the history of Earth is something that really excites you and brings a lot of like wonder to your life. You mentioned your sabbatical project. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of thinking about the history of Earth and how that might shape the work that you do every day.
Well, thank you for that. And what I've come to realize is that the Earth is far more resilient than we give it credit for. So we're talking about resilience as a common theme. And let me frame this broadly first. We've had life on our planet for about 4 billion years continuously. We've had life on our planet. And that what that implies is that we've also had a climate that's between freezing and boiling, right? 0 or 100 degrees centigrade or 32 and 212 Fahrenheit. It's actually been a pretty equitable planet for 4 billion years. The only reason why that's the case is that we have these amazing dynamic geologic, hydrologic, ecological systems that work together. Yeah, they're not thinking like, oh, I'm going to work together. They just do. And so in my research for this book, I was exploring, the book is called Climate Change and Life. And I was exploring these connections between climate change in the past and ecosystem development. And I started off with the story of the three sisters. That is Venus, Earth, and Mars. We are all at about the right distance from the sun to have liquid water on them. We are all about the same size. We all apparently in our early history had water. In fact, it's very likely that we all had life. All three of these planets might have had life, but Venus got too hot. Mars got too cold. Mars didn't have the right kind of internal geologic engine and Venus was just simply too close to the sun, and it lost its normal greenhouse protections. And now that they're largely lifeless, I say largely because I still hold out hope that on Mars we'll find some microbe in the deep surface. I don't know. We'll see. But the Earth has managed to weather that because it's the baby bear, right? Well, there's mama bear, papa. It's actually the zone of planetary distance from a given star is called the Goldilocks zone. It's an area that we expect to find liquid water, depending on the gas composition of the planet. So I explore through this book, I explore some of the huge insults that the planet has faced and how it's bounced back. You're talking about falling down on your steps and thank goodness you've been lifting and working out more. Well, the Earth has also been lifting and working out all its history. So if you indulge me, I've got a couple of examples. The first one is that from about 4 billion years to about 2.2 billion years ago. I know I say it like a geologist, like it was yesterday. That's a long time ago, but that's all right. The Earth had this ocean that was teeming with biological life. It was all very simple life. It was algae. So think of like the green muck of an algae. It was all that, but it was cooking away. It was doing its own thing. And at some time point during that time, it learned how to do photosynthesis the way we think of photosynthesis, right? So it takes carbon dioxide and breaks water apart with the power of sunlight to make oxygen and sugar. That's all photosynthesis does. And so it was pumping away oxygen. It's like, hey, this is pretty cool. This is a pretty efficient system of photosynthesis. This was about, you know, by at least about 2.7 billion years ago. And eventually, all of its waste product oxygen was sucked away by a chemical reaction. That's the reaction of rusting metal. We had a ton of iron on our planet. We still do. But all of it was unrusted at the time, right? So the little micro would produce oxygen and immediately zip, it would turn into rust from iron, and its pollutant byproduct was gone, right? It doesn't want too much oxygen in the environment because then it actually can't function very well. So it was doing its own thing, making a lot of oxygen. Iron was sucking it all away until, guess what? We ran out of enough iron. And when that happened, the oxygen started accumulating freely in water and in the atmosphere above it. Once it did that, it stripped out all of the methane that was keeping our planet warm at that time. So we had greenhouse gases even back then. It stripped it out. The planet went into huge deep freeze, huge mass extinction. Almost everything died. And that microbe that had been kicking out this toxin, oxygen, for that long, was now like suddenly was in charge of the planet in a sense. And it managed to weather through that transition and into the planet that we know of today. So if you were to classify a horrible polluter back then, it would be these bacteria. They were the worst planetary polluters you can even imagine, even worse than us. But it set the stage for our planet, right? And then our planet adjusted to like, oh, now we have oxygen. Now, guess what? We have enough oxygen. We can make an ozone layer to protect the planet from UV radiation. So now life can slowly evolve and come on land. And then guess what? It's on land. That's great. We can evolve into, you know, people who do podcasts eventually. Granted, I breezed over 2 billion years, you know, but what's 2 billion years among friends?
You know, that it is so great to hear that story. Again, you're telling it in terms of a story, and it really is helpful to have it framed that way. And I think it's really helpful for our listeners in the same way. And what you're describing is that there is doom and gloom and there are some fearful signs. However, is the planet going to stop? Probably not. You know, it probably is going to have some mechanism. Now, whether humans can survive it or not is a question. But there is probably some mechanism, and there will be some life that it'll readjust, you know, and it's working on it now. I think that's the other thing that people forget, Gabe, isn't it? That the planet is trying now to correct. It's trying to help us.
Yep. 90% of our carbon emissions are being sucked up by the ocean and absorbed by the ocean, which is nice for us, maybe not so great for the ocean. But yeah, the planet's just doing its own thing.
Yeah, it's trying to do it. I want to thank you, Gabe, so much for being a part of this kind of journey through the geological cycle and also through climate change and resiliency. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Until next time, I'm Dr. Krista Longton, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
Yay.
Cool. Thank you guys for asking me. Yeah. Ask me on.
This is fun.
I'm usually on the...
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.